Welcome to the River Mountain Church Preaching Library. It is our prayer and indeed our hope that this message might inspire your life. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the preaching of God's Word.
But Micah tells us that God requires us to act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly. Here's the actual context. He has shown thee, and this is from the King James, he has shown thee, O man, what is good and what the Lord requires of thee, but to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with thy God. These three things are part of God's requirement. They are the three basic requirements, and we will see again in the New Testament that these things have not been done away with. First of all, to do justly or to do right by other people. Secondly, to love mercy. And thirdly, to walk humbly with thy God. Can you back me down just a little bit? I'm getting a little feedback here. Just back my volume down on my mic. Just a little bit there, not much. So here's Jesus addressing this with the scribes and the Pharisees, who he called hypocrites. And the way he couches this is that they paid tithes on the mint and the cumin and have omitted the weightier matters of the law. In other words, they were focusing in on little nuances, like me skipping one of those words. They focused in on little nuances instead of focusing in on the big things. The big things are judgment, how we treat people, how we judge people, mercy, faith, and these things are the most important. He says you shouldn't have omitted tithing, even on the smallest things, but you shouldn't have left the bigger things undone. Again, judgment, mercy, and he terms walking humbly as faith, and we'll talk a little bit about that. But I want to talk about all three of these things. And I want to talk about what it means when he says, you have omitted the weightier matters. Do you know that not all of the commandments are equal? The same way, I sometimes hear people say, sin is sin. It's not true. There are greater sins and there are lesser sins. The same way, there are greater laws and lesser laws. Jesus wants us to always focus in on the weightier matters of the law or the things that are most important. Most essential. If you get these three things wrong, there's no way you can really follow all of the other commandments. And by the way, the primary commandments, all of them, are love. But if you get this wrong, you will totally not be able to even interpret the scriptures or how to live your life or how to follow God's laws. It's important for us to remember that in the Old Testament, there are 613 laws. That's a lot. The Pharisees and the scribes took each one of those 613 and added to them to the point that Jewish leaders told the people in the time of Jesus that there were 6,000 laws. Can you imagine following 6,000 laws? Today, the Jewish people still follow 613, not just the Ten Commandments, but these 613. Again, they were always elaborating on every single law, bringing the number up to 6,000. So what Jesus is addressing here is the tithing on the mint, especially these smaller seeds, because this goes back to Leviticus. This is Leviticus 27:30, that Every tithe was to be made on every single crop that you had, and even the seeds were to be tithed. So this is actually mint seeds. So can you imagine the Pharisees being so meticulous about tithing that they would sit down with all these seeds and would count them one by one? And they would say, 9 seeds I can keep, 1 seed is from the Lord. And they just did this. Now, that's a lot of seeds, and you would have to do this. This would take up hours on every seed of every crop. Think of a watermelon. Think of taking out every seed of a watermelon, making sure that at least one of those seeds went to the Lord. This is what they focused in on. This is what they loved. And if you saw a man doing this, you would say, man, he loves God. Look at how careful he is to carry out every single commandment. That is what Jesus is dealing with. He calls them blind guides who are straining out and camels. He says this in context to what he already said. The weightier matters are being ignored. That is to say, the camels are being ignored. And you are focusing in on tithing of seeds. You're straining gnats. Now, here are what Jewish people believed to be unclean. And you couldn't come in contact with any of these things. The largest unclean animal was the camel. The smallest unclean thing were insects. So they were careful not to partake of certain seafood, and they were also careful not to partake of certain animals. So is obviously unclean.
I have a lot of echo. Is that bothering anybody that I have a lot of echo in my voice? It isn't? It isn't? Okay. It's sort of bothering me. Maybe I'll stand over here. So the smallest unclean thing are insects. And so what the Jewish people did is that they would take, let's just say they were drinking wine, and that was a common drink of the day. They would run the wine through a strainer to make sure that there wasn't these microscopic insects that could make them unclean. So they were hyper-vigilant about the smallest of things, but yet they're swallowing camels. They are totally ignoring the bigger things. So he calls them hypocrites. Now it's clear, he said, hey, listen, you ought to be hyper-meticulous, but don't leave the big things undone, because the big things matter much more. Now, do you believe this spirit is still alive in the church today? That people focus in on... Let me give you an example of this. I've been a pastor for a long time, and I've met a lot of pastors. And I know pastors can stay in this pulpit and be totally full of pride. How many people think pride's a big sin? Huge. They could be in this pulpit and be unforgiving people, or even unloving people. They could be angry people. They could be that guy. It's all about me. And they could stay in these pulpits forever. But if they light up one cigarette, they're out. Do you know churches like this? One, an external thing, and they could be removed. Now, not all churches are like this, but there are a lot. We focus in on minor things. This always reminds me of the story of this. And by the way, I'm not a pro-smoker. I'm not. I took one puff of one cigarette because a cousin of mine held me at knife point to make me puff a cigarette. So I am not a fan of cigarette smoke. But this guy was. Charles Spurgeon was one of the greatest preachers of all time. Most people have his commentaries or quote Charles Spurgeon, one of the greatest men of God, but he smoked a cigar. And so one day he was confronted by D.L. Moody, who was one of the great evangelists in America. And Moody asked Spurgeon, because sometimes we struggle with people, you know, pastor who smokes, that's, you know, you struggle with that. So he asked Moody, how can a godly man smoke a cigar? And I love Spurgeon's response. He says, the same way a godly man can be as fat as you are. They both were portly men there, so they both had issues. But what my point is that we tend to pick out certain minor... And by the way, I've never looked at people that struggle with smoking cigarettes as having a good time. I never pictured that. I really pray for people that struggle in that area, but I don't view that as some, you know, thing they're enjoying. So to be a hypocrite, like the scribes and the Pharisees were, these are persons... And this is the word, the meaning of hypocrite, a person who puts on the false appearance of virtue and religion. And the way they do this is inside they may be full of corruption, but externally they're being very careful not to appear to be worldly or ungodly. So it's all about the appearance. It's a little like this. The godly person is focused in on the inward stuff, like a large carrot growing beneath the surface that nobody sees. The Pharisee has nothing inside him of value, but he's got to make it look like he's got a really big carrot in the ground. Do you see that? All what people see, not on what it actually is. Notice what Jesus says, beware of practicing your righteousness before other people in order to be seen by them. People always do a lot of good things, so that other people say, man, is he holy?
They like to practice their righteousness to be seen by others. When I was into looking like a minister, acting like a minister, trying to portray myself as a minister, people thought I was a lot holier than I really was. Today, it's probably, hopefully, the opposite. Because I do care about my inner life. I do not care about what people see. I do care about my intimacy with God. I do not care that people see a lot of good works. Now, some people say, well, shouldn't they see good works? No, my God needs to see my good works. As a matter of fact, if I'm practicing my good works to be seen, then I got the wrong idea here. The judgment, the mercy, these are the big inner things. These are harder to detect. It's harder to detect whether somebody is always doing right by people. It's harder to detect whether somebody is a merciful person. It's harder to detect if somebody is humble. But this is the big stuff to God. The outward appearance is not. Have you ever heard anybody say, whoa, is that dude merciful? No. Why? What do we view mercy as? Almost a weakness.
He's a pushover. He can get away with anything. He just forgives you.
We tend to like people who are like, don't cross me, man. Mercy is not exactly something that we brag about. And that's one of the reasons it's so highly sought after. God wants us to have these three things. These are the three requirements that you must have in order to even fulfill any of the laws. You need to treat people right. You need to always but love it. And then you need to walk humbly. If you don't have this, you don't really have anything. And so let's talk about loving mercy. What does this mean? You see, the Pharisees, hyper-vigilant about keeping the law, always wanted to trap Jesus. We are told in the Bible that if any person commits adultery with the wife of his neighbor, both the adulterer and the adulteress will be put to death. That is clear. That's chapter and verse. So tell me why, when they drag this woman before Jesus, why doesn't Jesus say, listen, the Bible says she's caught in the act of adultery. There's no question about this. Let's put her to death. Why does Jesus, instead of rushing to judgment, why does he do this? See, it says that they did this whole sham of bringing this woman. Look at what it says here. They said this what? To test him. They were trying to see if he would follow the Bible. Would he do what the Bible says? The Bible clearly says stone this person. What's Jesus going to do? And so Jesus looks like he's ignoring the question. What does he do? He bends down and he's writing something in the ground. People have speculated what he's writing on the ground. I is Micah 6:8. That's what I believe he's writing in the ground. The love of mercy is the highest. I want him to fulfill a law that seems higher. Woman caught in acts of adultery, she has to be stoned. We know what Jesus does. Jesus clears out all of the accusers by doing what he should do, and that is, instead of focusing on this woman's sin, whose sin should they focus on? Their own sin. We're watching this Supreme Court justice nominee, right, being brought before a tribunal of people, going back into his high school days. I would feel like saying to all of those, okay, let's bring your high school days in front of everybody. Hey, did you do anything stupid in high school? Let's get all your high school days. Did you do anything stupid in high school? Anybody here not do anything stupid in high school? But yet we can rise up to this high place of moral judgment and just look down. That's what they're doing. All similar to this. As a matter of fact, some people believe in the Greek that when he says, who are without sin, they believe the word is without this sin. Meaning, because remember Jesus had the high view of adultery that it's just looking at a woman to lust. You're telling me
You're gonna stone this one more. Well, if you have no sin like this, then go ahead and do it. Here's the definition of mercy, and I want you to see this. Elios is a Greek word that means this. It is a special and immediate regard to the misery which is the consequence of sins. You see a person sinning, and you know that that person has a misery attached to that sin. And you begin to feel compassion for the misery of the sin upon... How many people practice this? How many people, when they see a person sinning, go... We don't. And we are much more... And by the way, this is the goal of all of us, to become like Jesus. When we get to this place of being discipled by Jesus, we'll be just like him in our judgment. But see, the question is, was this person a wicked person? This woman caught in the act of adultery, was she wicked? Now, a lot of people say, yeah, she's sleeping with some guy. She's wicked. Or was she this? A lost and hurting person. See, this is the litmus test on whether you're practicing mercy. How do you view the sinner? As wicked or lost and hurting? Remember the story of the prodigal. The story of the prodigal is all about two views. The father's view, which is God's, and the religious view, which is the elder son. Are you a God-like person? The prodigal, the religious person says this about the prodigal. Listen, this son who came back, let me tell you, he devoured your property with prostitutes. Now, it doesn't say that that's what he did, but this is the assumption. He was sinning with prostitutes. And because he was sinning with prostitutes, the religious person says, you kill a fatted calf for him? I don't understand this. See, the elder religious person, the elder brother was saying he was having a good time, he was totally enjoying his sin. He believed that sin was enjoyable. It is for a season, a very small season, but sin is not. The father's perspective of all, it was fitting to celebrate and be glad, for this brother of yours was dead and is alive. He was lost. The father says this, he was totally lost and sin was killing him. Is that the way you view sin? Do you have mercy on the sinner because you say they cannot be happy? The Apostle Paul was always dealing with religious people. And religious people tend to major on minor things. I once had a religious person say to me, listen, you and I aren't going to have any problems spiritually if you believe that David played a minor D on his harp. Literally, somebody said that to me. If you believe David played a minor D on the harp, you do believe that, don't you? Oh, we're good then. We're good. I had somebody say that to me. Now, this person who said this to me had major ear. Not, he could be very judgmental, he could be very cruel, he could be angry. But David playing the minor D, that, do you understand what I'm saying here? So Paul says to these religious types, he says, listen, I want you to avoid controversy. I want you to avoid genealogies. Because all of these sub-issues,
now tell me, Pastor, do you believe in the Nephilims?
Why?
Do you believe there was a giant race of angels that cohabitated with men? Why? I just want to know what your position is on that. Why? These are the kind of people we deal with in the church. They're hung up.
I'm not going to get going on all this small stuff. And then I'll be guilty. Okay, controversy, genealogy. These cause dissensions. There's quarreling about the law. Worthless. And then he says this. Now, this is the point I want you to get. Because some people get so hypervigilant about little points and they forget big points. That eventually you got to do this. And this sounds hard. It says, as for the person who is stirring up division, after warning him once, then you warn him twice, and then if he's still hell-bent, and I'll use that word, hell-bent on causing division, then have nothing more to do with him. Knowing that such a person is warped and sinful and is self-condemned. Now, why do you think Paul has such a strong mandate against people that are focusing on minor things and not major things? Why do you think? It's a little bit like the leaven of the Pharisees. Jesus was very careful to say, make sure you have no leaven of the Pharisees in you. And so I think Paul is concerned about his church, that they not go over into legalism, go over into majoring in minor areas and not majoring in major areas. Here are young Titus. He says, gotta get this. And all of these things have to do with how you... He said, and this is right in the same chapter, he says this, remind them to be submissive to rulers and to authorities, to be obedient, to be ready for every good work. And then he says this, to speak evil of no one. If you begin speaking evil of a person, I've been a pastor for a long time, and it always is a perplexing and confusing thing why Christians attack other Christians. It's always confusing to me. Why Christians speak evil of one another. It's very confusing. And now that we have emails and texting, it's like, oh, goodness gracious. Listen, you got to stay away from that. What do you have to be? You have to be gentle. You have to show courteous toward all people. Paul is saying this is important. Not the genealogies, not the subpoints, this. Now, there are two branches in the church. People that say, listen, we're all sinners, we can live any way we want. We're Christians, but we're always going to be sinning, and these people tend to go into license. You know, they're Christians, and they're cursing, and they're getting drunk, and they're doing all this kind of crazy stuff. Listen, just because you've been saved by grace doesn't mean that you're just a sinner. You're not just a sinner saved by grace. You're a son of God. Imitate his heart. But here's the problem with that. The Bible not gratify the desires of the flesh. How many of you walk in the Spirit 24/7? I'm glad you didn't raise your hand. Because that would mean that you're sinless. That would mean that you don't have bad attitudes or bad thoughts or you do wrong things. The truth of the matter is most of us are not walking in the Spirit 24/7. So what does that mean? That means at some point you're going to catch me on a bad day and I might say something that hurts you or I might sin against you. Does anybody think the pastor is capable of that? If you call me on a Monday, I've had my devotions, but then I'm off, I don't know, playing in my treehouse, I guess, maybe. And so maybe I'm not, and by the way, I shouldn't use my treehouse. I'm calling it my treehouse. It was built for the kids, but I'm in it too much. So anyway, if your brother sins against you, it's going to happen. This is what you have to do. And this is kind of Christianity 101, but for some reason we don't get this. If somebody sins against you, and it's going to happen because we're not walking in the Spirit 24/7, you got to go to him. You tell him his faults. Look at this. It's private. You notice again in this trial that was dragged out in front of people, the Senate confirmation hearing. You know, over and over again we said, this could have been handled privately. We could have did this privately. We didn't have to drag this man in front of this tribunal. We didn't have to do that. But the way the enemy works is he loves for this not to happen. He loves for it not to be a private thing. Listen, it's between you and him alone. Alone. If he listens to you again, brother. Now, if that doesn't happen, here's what you're supposed to do. Now, notice what this says. If he does not listen to you, take one or two others along with you. Not just bystanders. Listen, that every charge, remember, there's a sin here. There's a charge may be established by what? The evidence. So the idea is the same sin. Or maybe they had the same sin done to them. And by the way, because we live used to live in a Christian society, all of this was like how our courts operated too. There was evidence by two or three witnesses. And so Can it be corroborated? Can it? And if it can't, then we can't really go any further. But the two or three. But then if that doesn't happen, then you do this. If it refuses to listen, then you tell it to the church. And it's not tell it to everybody in the church. There were certain people that were designated, and I'll tell you why this doesn't mean everybody in the church. It says if they refuse to listen to the church authority, then treat them like a Gentile or tax collector. I am so proud of our church for so many reasons. But perhaps the greatest reason I am proud of this church, if I can use that terminology, is because I believe this is a merciful church. I believe we are merciful upon merciful upon merciful. I believe we always want people to be restored. But you might say to yourself, well, wait a second. Merciful. The Bible doesn't sound very merciful because it seems to say that when somebody doesn't listen after being warned a few times, after being confronted a few times, get rid of them. Does that sound like mercy? And the answer to that question is yes. Because let me tell you something. People who are in sin love drama. I don't know why they love drama, but they love drama. People who have no life will always try to start drama in your life. The church is a place of called out drama. So Paul eventually says, listen, if somebody is not going to stop causing division, remove them. Drama. Program. In Galatians, it is quite clear. If a brother is caught, and by the way, it says caught. Most people don't get caught in their sins, right? Most people are able to practice their sins secretly, privately. You may say a bad curse word, but nobody heard you, so it doesn't have to be a public thing. But this is somebody who got caught. You get caught in a transgression. It's a public sin. What's to happen? Listen, it says spiritual people, you who are spiritual. This usually means elders, pastors, deacons, people who are spiritual. And what should they do with that person? They should punish him. They should throw him out. No, they should restore him. How should they do it? In a spirit of gentleness.
Thanks for listening to this message from River Mountain Church. If you'd like some more information, visit our website, rivermountainchurch.org.